I'm Leonard Lopate. Welcome to my show. Sarah Chase used to work as a foreign correspondent for NPR, but now she's a soap maker in Kandahar, Afghanistan. She's continued to report on the situation from Afghanistan over the past few years on this show, speaking via sometimes rather inadequate phone lines. But I'm pleased that today she has joined me in studio. And Sarah, welcome back to my show. And it's so great to meet you in the flesh.
Likewise.
There's a two-day donors conference on Afghanistan that began today in London. But it's expected that most of the talk will be about the Hamas victory in Palestine and Iran's nuclear plans. Why do you think Afghanistan's problems always seem to be put on the back burner?
You know, it almost seems like Afghanistan was an afterthought from the very beginning. When you read some of the really interesting books that are starting to come out about the Iraq experience, you start to see that pretty much from September 12th, 2001, this administration was thinking about Iraq, and I, you know, heard on the ground in Afghanistan, and then it's been corroborated by things I've read more recently, that resources were being moved off of Afghanistan starting February 2002. I mean, like, instantly. And so I think that basically no one was ever interested in Afghanistan to start with.
They seem to be interested in doing the whole thing on the cheap. I recently had the CIA officer who was in charge of capturing Osama bin Laden, and he requested that they drop in 600 to 800 American troops. He was there mostly with Afghan troops who had mixed feelings about the whole thing.
And he, mixed competence, I would
yes.
add.
And then 600 to 800 American troops to seal off the border, and the U.S. military refused to do it.
My personal view is that that wouldn't have changed anything in terms of capturing Osama bin Laden, because this is not at all substantiated by anything except sense. I don't think that he was in the country even, you know.
No, they actually had walkie-talkies and phones that they were using to communicate, and he was there. But he got out.
He got out. It's not only that it's on the cheap. What really distresses me is that even the money that arrives in Afghanistan is not being spent in a way that's making an impact. So much of it gets kind of stuck in a sieve up in Kabul and gets spent really on U.S. or, you know, donor nation goods and services that, you know, even if the amount of money that's been spent and the amount of energy that's been spent on Afghanistan were actually focused on the people who are supposed to be receiving it, were actually getting out there, I think it would be fine.
But Kabul is a city with great need. It was bombed.
Oh, no, it's not the city
years.
Of Kabul. It's not the
is
city.
Is it going to be rebuilt, do you think?
No. I mean, there's some rebuilding that's happening. The real devastated neighborhood that looks like Grozny, basically, is kind of starting to. But I'm actually surprised at how little money is being spent on the city of Kabul. When I say getting stuck in Kabul, I mean in the headquarters of these international organizations.
Now, what's happening with you? You're in Kandahar, a city that was less devastated, but also seems to be an afterthought after an afterthought. It was the center of Taliban activity. What happened?
Well, and that's why I really wanted to go there. It was the de facto capital of the Taliban, but it also is kind of the marrow of the bones of Afghanistan as a nation. It was the first capital of Afghanistan, and it's where its rulers have always come from. And my feeling was, if we lose Kandahar, this whole experiment is not going anywhere. And I mean, you can see reconstruction and things like that, but just to illustrate what I said before, there's a whole program called the Alternative Livelihoods Program, which is funded by the United States Agency for International Development, the kind of U.S. government donor for overseas development. And it's implemented by one of these big for-profit contractors. It's called Chemonix. It's a $17 million program to try to get, you know, things underway that will give people a livelihood other than opium in the Afghan South. And that's exactly what we're trying to do with our little soap baking project. And it's small, and it's grassroots, and it's a cooperative and things like that. But I actually got 18 people to sign a contract, 18 elders of a district to sign a contract to plant roses, which we're then going to distill and make rose oil and things like that. And I spent 6 months developing a proposal with these alternative livelihoods people. And, you know, 6 months and a business plan and a spreadsheet that just kind of went on and on and on and on and on. And they finally couldn't come up with any money for us. And the fact is they haven't come up with any money for anybody. They've been there for 8 months, and they haven't done any projects.
So maybe that's why there's so little industry, and that's the reason the government has to rely almost totally on foreign aid.
That's right. That's right. I mean, there's just no imagination or very little imagination in terms of the donors as to how you go about reconstructing an economy, which they kind of want a one-shot deal. It's like, what could we come up with that in and of itself would replace opium? And that's not how an economy works.
Because opium is the only thing that's making any money there. Does this mean anything for the country? Because tax revenues are very low. Does any of the opium money actually come back into the economy?
Not officially. It comes back in a very politico mafia kind of way, where you have governors in the South who are in charge of the trafficking routes and who obviously get plenty of money, but that doesn't mean it goes into the economy in that way. However, it is supporting the entire population of the Afghan South.
And it's been suggested that if instead of trying to destroy the opium, the poppies, they were simply bought and used for medical opiates like morphine, then this would be a legitimate business and nobody would be upset.
I think that is a nice idea, but it does imply a rule of law. And because presumably legal opiates would be bought for less than illegal opiates. So you would have the traffickers trying to outbuy the, you know... And there is no rule of law at all in the Afghan South.
So what does that mean for you? First of all, let me tell people that Sarah Chase is here. She worked for NPR for many years as a foreign correspondent and then decided to do something more basic. She developed a commune that makes soap called Arghand?
Argand, yeah.
Argand.
A cooperative, I would say. We don't actually live together, but...
I said commune,
you
meant
said
cooperative.
Commune. Yeah, a cooperative. Soap and bath oils and all that kind of thing. The idea was, you know, there's all this great stuff down there. Almonds and apricots and all these things that are good for your skin, and why not make some money out of it?
Are you the only one who's doing something like this?
There's something a little bit similar in Herat, which is much more basic and for the local market. It's like tomato paste and things like that for the local market. There is one other person working in essential oils in Afghanistan that I know of.
So what is it like to run a business in Afghanistan? First of all, what is security like?
You know, someone said something to me that had a really profound impact on how I would answer that question, because I get asked it a lot. I mean... the situation is not good, meaning people are getting picked off pretty much every day at this point. And those people are people who are connected with the current experiment, meaning school teachers, district officials, police officers, things like that. And the coalition, the military convoys are a really constant target. Humanitarian workers have been less of a target of late than they had been a few years ago. But it's not great. But the answer to that question really is a little bit deeper than that, which is that if you focus on security as your ultimate objective, you tend to actually make yourself less safe. Whereas, meaning, you know, you drive around in a military convoy and that makes you less safe, or you have barbed wire, or whereas if you focus on other things as your objective, you become more safe.
The reason I ask is there's a film called the Kabul Beauty Academy, and although it was filmed a few years back, the women who, the Afghan women who come to the Beauty Academy all talk about not being able to go out after dark. They would just be assaulted in one way or another. At least that's what they said then. They also talked about, and this I think is something that might be more germane to your situation, that Afghan men didn't like taking orders from women when they were telling, they were trying to build this this beauty shop. The men really were annoyed. They had to find relatively enlightened men who then would pass on the orders.
I'm kind of out of category because I'm a foreigner, and also because I've had a kind of swashbuckling existence in Kandahar and have taken on the governor, the sort of warlord governor, and in a kind of public way. And I drive a truck around town and stuff like that. And so basically, I'm an honorable man in terms of my interaction.
But do you cover your hair?
I do, but so do most men. I mean, I don't cover it with a scarf. I cover it with a kind of small version of a turban. You know, that doesn't kind of come out here that most men cover their hair, too, you know. And we have women and men in our organization. And we don't have other women in a management. I mean, there's not enough of us to need more managers than me. But my guys don't have any problem taking, I wouldn't say orders, because I don't. What's most peculiar about the way we do it is that it's much more democratic than any organization any of them have any experience with. And even other friends of mine who work in other NGOs, say, but Sarah, you're way too egalitarian with these guys. But it's working.
Well, we're talking about a country of 25 million people, aren't we? How many of them are working?
That's a really good question. I mean, part of the problem is that there aren't any statistics. And people are really impoverished. I mean, one of my women, we rinse our soap in water to smooth off the surface of it. And she takes home the soapy water at night so that she can wash her clothes in it. I mean, that's the degree. I have no way of saying how many people are employed, but what I know is that employment is the number one issue. Every day I get requests to hire people.
There's a piece in Today's Times, and they said that the country has some of the worst economic and health indicators in the world. So I was wondering what that actually means for somebody who's living in that situation.
Again, I have someone who's working for me who takes soapy water home so that she can wash her clothes in it. That's pretty stunning.
But she's probably privileged.
She's enormously privileged because she has a job at really slightly above market. I mean, I can't totally distort. First of all, we don't have enough money for me to be able to distort the market. But you also, this needs to be a viable organization. It needs to fit into the local economy. So I can't pay five times the local wage, you know. So she makes slightly under $100 a month. That's the salary for the women. They, I let them leave early because then they have to go home and do all their housework. So, you know. Health indicators, again, I'm kind of out of the system because if I really needed health care, I could go to the U.S. base and persuade Charlie Med to patch me up. But again, another of my women had an impacted tooth. I mean, she had an infected tooth. Her face was swollen. And the only thing that Afghan doctors know how to do is pull the tooth out. I mean, you know, so health is a massive issue.
And then is it true that 80% of the population is illiterate?
Yes.
Is that a consequence of the Taliban's policies?
Not just the Taliban. It was also the anti-Soviet jihad. Ironically, because the Soviet-backed government was the government and schools were provided by the government, the resistance often destroyed a lot of schools. So you're really looking at a country that has not had access to educational resources for about 20 years.
And that continues to be a problem, according to news reports. A school teacher was recently beheaded, and I assumed that it was because he was teaching girls, but it turned out he wasn't.
No. In the next village outside of Kandahar, I happened to know the district police chief, and I went to talk to him because I heard some rumor about someone who had been killed in a school, and it was the night guardian of a regular school. You know, who had first been warned and told, you need to leave your job. And he said, I can't. This is my job. He was killed, and there was a note pinned to his body that named all of the teachers in this, or a number of the teachers in the school, and said, you people have to stop teaching at the school closed immediately. And this is really the issue that I've been most struck by in the last, I would say, month, is the intimidation campaign around Kandahar that is really separating the Afghan population from this current regime, whatever we want to call it. And it doesn't take killing a lot of Afghans to intimidate a lot more.
And the goal is to separate them from the regime?
That's correct.
I mean, the goal also to keep people illiterate? To what end?
No. The goal is not necessarily to keep people illiterate. The goal, this counts as part of the government. And the goal is to make it impossible for the government to function.
So is that done by remnants of the Taliban?
Yes and no, in the sense that probably the people who are doing it had a role in the Taliban regime, but just like the Taliban regime, they are manufactured, financed, and motivated across the border in Pakistan. It's not an indigenous uprising against the regime the way Iraq is.
My guest is Sarah Chase, C-H-A-Y-E-S.
Thank you.
You stay here. We have more.
No, I know, but I'm saying thank you for spelling my name, because that's why I pronounce it weird, is because it's spelled weird.
She is a former correspondent for NPR, now living in Kandahar, back in the States for a little visit. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Sarah Chase, formerly of NPR, now of the Arkand soap business. And we'll get more into that soap business in a little bit. But I was wondering, if there's little industry, does that mean the government has to rely totally on foreign aid?
Largely. And, you know, this is an old... Afghanistan is schematically an impenetrable wall with two doors through it. So that's the natural resource of Afghanistan, is controlling those doors. But you've got three. You've got Central Asia, the Iranian plateau, and the Indian subcontinent. And Afghanistan controls the access between those three. So they've always lived on subsidy of one kind or another.
But they've always been considered a major strategic place. And
that's right.
Why so many countries tried to conquer it over the years.
That's right. And deliver subsidy. So you can kind of look at the foreign aid that's being delivered now as an extension of the kind of subsidy that Great Britain and Russia were paying the Afghan government in the 19th century.
An Afghan government official is quoted in today's Times as saying that it will be at least 5 years more, take at least 5 years more of international help before Afghanistan can come close to financing its own budget. Do you think that's likely in 5 years? From what you're saying, it sounds like it's a long, long way off.
Well, I think it could take 5 years if there were a plan and if there were steps to achieve that plan. I mean, there's some very basic things that just never really happened. I think the Afghan government did produce a plan pretty early on, and the U.S. government, from my understanding, kind of dismissed it. And so there are all these people who come for 6 months and do something, but that doesn't really hold together and doesn't really constitute a vision for the economic reconstruction of this country.
Well, there is this conference, as we said, in London 2 days, starting today, and Afghanistan is expected to sign a compact to get the money. And it calls for meeting concrete benchmarks. I'd like to pass some of them by you.
Very interesting.
Administrative improvements, equality for women, democratization and human rights, addressing corruption and the power of the warlords, a merit-based government and judicial appointments rather than tribal-based or regional power, an end to land grabbing and guarantee of property rights. Are any of those goals realistically attainable?
I think they're attainable with the political will. With the exception of equal rights for women, that's just out of the question in the next 5 years. I mean,
But they used to be equal rights for women.
Not equal. They were never equal. They were equaler than they are now, but they were never anything like equal. So you can make progress on that front, but there, you know, that. But what you need is political will. These goals are what the Afghan population wants. I mean, the Afghan population gave President Hamid Karzai a mandate to do precisely those things, and he hasn't touched it. It's just rampant the opposite of those goals.
But you're a friend. You've been a supporter and a friend of Hamid Karzai.
And I'm desperately disillusioned by him. I mean, I really took him at face value. I really believed in him. And I've had personal interactions with him. And I've, you know, tried to get him to do some of the stuff that the Afghan population wants him to do. And he's just not doing it. And he blames it on the Americans. And the Americans blame it on him. And nothing's going anywhere.
So now the Afghan mediators here or are agreeing to do all of this. What does that mean? Do you think that
I don't think
the
it
government
means anything?
What about Parliament, new Parliament?
Let me back up just a second and say that on governance, for example, which has now become the buzzword, I sat down, you know, which is their government accountability and corruption and things like that. I sat down with the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan about a month or so ago for an hour. And I said, look, the Afghan population really wants us to impose some accountability on these regional, but it's particularly the governors. That's where the rubber hits the road.
The United States? They want the United States
to
do it?
Yes, they do, because these governors have so much weapon, so much, you know, firepower and so much money that the people can't do it and the central government isn't doing. And they really are looking at to us not to govern in their place, but to demand accountability for the resources that we are applying, we are offering. So I said to the ambassador, look, for example, when a friend of mine had 20 wells. He works in a non-governmental organization, an Afghan. He had 20 wells that he could drill in a certain district. And the district chief says, well, you're going to drill them in these two villages. And he says, well, no, I'm not. I'm going to do an assessment and find out which villages need. And he had a huge fight with this district chief. Well, I told the ambassador, it would be really great if this friend of mine had somebody that he could go to who would then put pressure on the governor to oblige the transparent distribution of these resources. And the ambassador didn't want to go anywhere near it. So we have these nice formulations in places like London. But when the rubber hits the road, nobody wants to actually hold people accountable and actually do this kind of nitty-gritty work.
Well, who could do it? Does it have to all be imposed by outsiders?
I think for a while it does. I really do, because, you know, and so what I suggested to him is why don't you set up a commission in Kandahar that would include the head of the airbase, the head of the provincial reconstruction team, the USAID representative, and one or two independent, honest Afghan community leaders. And you have that commission, which would be a place where somebody like my friend could go and say, my project is being held up for political reasons here. And then they take that issue to the governor and tell the governor, this isn't on. This guy is your appointee. You have to lean on him to make this be distributed in a fair fashion. And the ambassador didn't want to hear anything about it.
My guest is Sarah Chase, who has just returned from Kandahar, Afghanistan. And this is WNYC 93.9 AMA 20. We're online at WNYC.org. How long are you back for?
I'm back for about a month, doing a combination of interacting with people like you and trying to find retail outlets for our soap.
Do you feel like Afghanistan is your home now?
That's an excellent question. I don't think I could live in Afghanistan without being able to come back to the West periodically, meaning at least once or twice a year. But I think it's possible. I've started to joke around with, you know, about running for mayor of Kandahar, and people are taking it a little bit seriously.
But there must be some kind of culture shock, because you talk about a woman who takes soapy liquid at home every night to wash clothes. You come here and there are whole aisles in supermarkets just filled with a choice of detergents.
I'm having more culture shock this trip than I have on my last couple of trips. And I think it's because I've reentered this experience of, you know, the last couple of times I came back to the States, I really laid low and I did some research and I hung out with my mother. So I didn't have quite as much integration into this social and economic system. And I'm just finding I'm having a little bit of overload. When I go back to Afghanistan, I always go into deep depression for the first week that I'm there. And the reason for that is that the situation, at least in Kandahar, but not only Kandahar, is deteriorating. And it's really kind of the experience of the frog in the boiling water. When you stick a frog in boiling water, it jumps out because it's hot. But if you put a frog in cold water and warm it up very, very slowly, it doesn't notice it and it will die in the water. And so when I'm there, I'm actually not feeling the deterioration, because we're living and the sky isn't falling and we're having fun and things are happening. But when you come out and then experience the deterioration, it's a shock.
Hasn't the history of Afghanistan been kind of constant? After the Soviets left, we had all the various Mujahideen factions, the warlords, fighting for power, jockeying for power. After the Taliban left, As a recent guest pointed out, nobody seemed to be interested in securing the country or capturing the Taliban. They all wanted to go to Kabul and claim power. And if they weren't doing that, they were going back to their home areas and imposing
power. That's right. Well, I see it a little bit differently.
Is democracy possible?
Democracy is absolutely possible. And the Afghan population knows what it is. They want it. And you know, they want from their government pretty much what we want from ours. They want a stake in it. They want to have some say in the future destiny of their country. They want schools. They want roads. They want a doctor who doesn't poison, you talked about healthcare, poison their kids by prescribing six different contradictory medicines because, you know, that's what they want. But I don't subscribe to the view that, you know, a lot of people have also said about the Balkans. Oh, they've always been fighting each other and they're all going to, you know, they're always going to be fighting each other. And it's hopeless. No, I see history as contingency. Specific things happened that brought out one tendency rather than another tendency at specific junctures. And what those were was, I mean, Afghanistan is a tribal culture. It is a very democratic culture in the sense that you have tribal elders and they, you know, reach a consensus about a collective decision. What happened during the anti-Soviet invasion was that we poured money and weaponry into the hands of some of these regional and tribal leaders, and that put them above the reach, out of reach of their countrymen who could no longer impose accountability on them. It was like a cancer. They became like cancerous cells. And the one thing you can say about the Taliban is that it was the civil war was so chaotic. It was such total breakdown of law and order that, frankly, at least the South saw the Taliban as it was like the only version of government on offer. And they accepted it. And now what we did was basically re-inject those cancerous tumors back into the body politic.
And I gather there are some people who have a certain nostalgia for the order and discipline
Absolutely.
That the Taliban brought.
I mean, you could cross the city without being in danger of your life, and now you can't.
Well, how much of this is tribal? I mean, you mentioned the Balkans, because we are talking about a country where the Pashtun are major players, and you have the Tajiks, and they were the major opposition to the Taliban. There are the Persians in the south, the Iranians, there are any number of other groups. To my eye, they all look pretty much like the same people, like a Turkic kind of people, but I imagine that one can spot somebody from the other group.
Oh, yeah. You can definitely, partly from their clothing, because they do set themselves off often by headgear. The headgear kind of is different. But for example, when I'm in Kabul, I speak Pashto, which is the language in the south, and I speak it with a distinctly southern accent. There are different consonants and things like that. And when I am in Kabul, I don't speak Persian, which is the dominant language in the north. And so if I go to buy something in a shop, I first say, excuse me, do you speak Pashto? And they burst out laughing because there's this foreigner who it would be like someone coming to New York with a, you know, West Virginia accent or something like that, you know. And so those ethnic distinctions are very strong and are very keenly felt. For example, Ahmed Shah Massoud, who is a Tajik and he's actually half Pashtun. He was half Pashtun. But he was the kind of hero of the Northern Alliance, which fought against the Taliban.
And assassinated
long before 2 days the US before 9/11, actually. He was assassinated 2 days before 9/11. In Kabul now, it's hero worship. There are pictures of him all over the city. You can't have a picture of him in Kandahar. He is not seen not because he fought against the Taliban, but because people remember what he did during this civil war. And he was not such a great guy during the civil war. So there's a lot of inter-ethnic resentment. But there's some amazing stories. One of my best friend in Afghanistan, who unfortunately was assassinated this summer, was a police chief. And he was as Pashtun as you could ask for. I mean, he was a classic. And he was assigned, he was first police chief of Kandahar, and then he was assigned to Mazar-e-Sharif, which is the town in Afghanistan that hates the Pashtuns the most because there was an exchange of basically devastating war crimes between ethnic groups. And here this Pashtun from Kandahar shows up in this town, and he won it over. He was a great guy, and he came back, his Persian got really good, and, you know, all of that kind of thing.
But then he was assassinated.
He was assassinated. And I think that's one of the reasons he was assassinated, is because this guy could unite the country. Now, another point is that within the Pashtun ethnic group, there are different tribes. So in Kandahar, where there are no Tajiks, I mean, there's almost no ethnic diversity in Kandahar, there's massive tribal rivalry and diversity. So there is a kind of centrifugal, it's true, there's a centrifugal tendency in the Afghan polity.
We have very little time left, so I want to talk a bit about your soaps. They're artisanal. So no two bars look exactly the same?
That's right. The idea of the project is, you know, there's a lot of valuable stuff that's being grown in Kandahar, but it's perishable. I mean, pomegranates. Now, you know, we're reading about pomegranates all over the place. This is the pomegranate capital of the world, and there's Persian poetry from the 11th century singing the glory of Kandahar pomegranates. You know,
I love pomegranates.
They're great. The problem is that they're perishable and they're heavy. So, and there's also almonds and apricots and, you know, all of this stuff down there. And so I thought, well, maybe we could turn it into something that's light and non-perishable. So I thought soap and essential oils and body oils and stuff like that. And what's really amazing is I almost want to call the project Guns and Roses. I mean, I've got gunmen who have put down their guns and they're working with me and they're sorting roses and they're getting ecstatic about our essential oils. It's very poetic.
A number of listeners want to know how to get this. Now, I know that you have a website, www.arghand.org.
That's right.
And that's pretty much the best place to go?
I think that's the best place. And you can actually, you can write to info@arghand.org.
Meanwhile, we'll probably post that address on our website as well.
Yeah.
And Sarah, when are you back? When are you going back to Afghanistan?
I should be there toward the end of the month.
And
toward the end of February.
And I hope that you will continue giving us reports.
I would love it. Thank you so much for being so welcoming.
And thank you so much, Sarah Chase, who now is, I don't know what word to use, but is working with the cooperative Arghand, and you can check out what they sell at www.arghand.org. It's been a real pleasure meeting you.
My pleasure.